Welcome to the last of this quarter's exciting LBC podcast, coming to you from the swanky Rialto Theater. I'm here with Ed. Ed, this is it. The final book, the one you nominated. You've got to speak up. This is a collaboration. Time for the introduction. Ed, talk to me. You liked this book. What did the book do to you? What did you do to the book? It's Vermin by Sam Savage. Ed? Is it because the book's protagonist can't talk, Ed? Are you empathizing with the narrator again? Vermin is a rat, Ed. You're a person. You're a bipedal life form, one who's slightly lactose intolerant. You can talk. All right, then. To introduce Vermin, here is nominator Ed Champion. Ed, come on! I think he may actually be on tape.
I'm talking here to Ed Champion. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Carolyn. How are you doing?
I'm excellent, and you know why? Because I have just read this book, Vermin, and I understand that you nominated it to the LBC.
I did, as a matter of fact.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I read this book. It was one of the few tomes I actually picked up at Book Expo America. I was really sort of being, you know, hyper selective about the books that I was picking up. And I ran into Alan at Coffee House, who basically told me that there was this book here about a rat. And I said to myself, ooh, this sounds really interesting, because I'm always looking for that have a different kind of perspective to it. And I read the book back on the plane because I was completely exhausted and basically sort of, you know, galvanized in a weird decaying sense by all of the sort of business that was running around at Book Expo, but that's beside the point. And I completely fell in love with this little story about a rat, or is he a rat, named Vermin, who is addicted to books to the point where he basically eats them. And it just seems this incredible sort of almost parable-like story involving the dangers of fiction and imagination and getting too caught up in books, which is something I'm sure that both of us can actually relate to. And it was just, you know, when it came around and the hat was passed around and I, you know, my name was drawn, I waffled over, you know, several books, but Vermin was kind of the kind of clear front runner to me. It just seemed such an unusual perspective, a perspective that I really hadn't seen in fiction in something in a long while.
What's fortunate about the circumstance of this conversation is that we're having it, and we both know that LBC, the co-op together, chose Vermin as the pick for the fall. So that must be pretty exciting for you. And what were some of the things that the other LBC people said about the book that you'd nominated that struck you as being accurate or insightful or interesting?
Well, that's a rather leading question, Miss Kellogg. Actually, if you're referring to Jessica's very perspicacious comments upon the site this week, I think that it's a very interesting sort of point, which Sam Savage himself brought up, that this book can kind of be read from all types of perspectives. One of the nice things about this book, one of the reasons I really love it, is that there is no sort of clear-cut answer for whether Vermin himself is a rat, or whether he's actually a human, he could be anything. Who is this kind of character who is supposedly a rat, who both simultaneously lusts after his sister's bottom, and also reports that he has conversations with other people in bars? It's never clear-cut exactly what the answer is, and I really am a big fan of books that present these kinds of ambiguities.
Let's take a step back from the meta for a second. Is there anything about the content of the book that would, in your view, recommend it to someone who hasn't yet had a chance to read it?
Well, as I was attempting to answer that last question, one thing I wanted to note was how entertaining this book is. It's both ambiguous and entertaining, and it really kind of keeps you guessing as to what's going on. If you are a literary person, you will note the many references, for example, to, you know, he's complaining about his first line at the beginning, and he's asking, you know, and he's citing other books to try to determine what his own relationship with literature is. And I think it's sort of telling of this general kind of atmosphere where books are the only refuge for Furman.
You met with him in person in Wisconsin, right?
Yes, that is correct.
There's probably, I'm sure that your conversation is totally engaging, and we're about to hear that. But tell me a little bit about the physical circumstances in which you met him. And if, I mean, Sam, his picture on the book leaf is very striking. He's like a 60-something-year-old guy with a long white beard. Is that really what he looks like? And what's it like to
yes,
be around
it
him?
It is, but he's a very kind and friendly and gentle person. I went to his house. It was this really nice, immaculate house. It actually had a impeach Bush placard out in the middle of this area of Madison, which was by this beautiful lake. And, you know, Sam Savage, everyone's been kind of going on, oh, he's like this bearded guy. No, he's really just a sweet, gentle guy, and I think the conversation will speak for itself.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. Okay, I'm going to...
Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Okay, I'm turning off the record button.
So I am here with LBC nominee Sam Savage, who is the author of Furman, a novel that is told entirely from the perspective of a rat. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
First off, I want to actually ask, given the ending, which I won't reveal, and how, you know, why was it a rat that you decided upon above anything else?
Well, I didn't really decide upon it. You know, I wrote the first, I suppose, the two pages pretty much the way they stand in the book today, almost word for word, and I didn't know it was a rat. Ah. As I knew who it was, I had the feel of the character, the grandiosity, the sentimentality, the romanticism, the despair, the self-loathing. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was I thought it was a man. So I knew the speaker. And I thought, well, I'm onto something. I know who this person is. And then I went to bed, got up the next day, and sat down, and I said, you know, I think this is a rat. And it was really a surprise. But as soon as it happened, then I realized this is exactly what I wanted. Exactly.
Really?
Yeah, because I could jump. It was as though you could cut through all the clutter of the novel. You know, where did he go to school? How did he get so lonely?
Yeah.
Why did his wife leave him? How did he end up in this room alone? So I didn't need all that. It was jump right in the middle. I had a character totally isolated, totally mute.
Once you knew that Furman was a rat, or the narrator was a rat, I'm not sure if you even had his name then.
No, he didn't have a name yet.
But there's the thing that's also really remarkable about this book to me is the fact that you go into how, like, the rats who had lived before, thousands of them had created this kind of great sort of, like, you know, tunneling sort of system through the buildings.
Right.
And how there's this sort of perspective that very much, like, I'm not sure if you've read Mr. Sullivan's book on rats for this.
No.
I'm wondering, in terms of, like, how the actual sort of perspective kind of flowed once you knew that it was a rat, what sort of steps did you take to kind of, you know, sort of expand things, or were there specific rules that you set down to sort of, you know, how much you would tell about a rat's life? Or?
Well, you know, I didn't investigate rats, mm-hmm. except to find out how many nipples they had, and that was all the zoological information that I had about rats. Because, you know, I knew that Furman was about being a human, not about being a rat.
Yeah.
And that the rat was metaphor. And that so I didn't really need to know anything about. I'm not trying to project myself into the life of a rat.
Yeah.
I couldn't if I wanted to. Yeah. And the story itself unfolded. I wrote every day for about 6 months. I was living alone in a house in South Carolina, and my family was away, and I was completely alone, and I wrote every day for quite a few hours, and I really did not know where I was going. And I really did not know, usually, a paragraph beyond where I was going. Mm-hmm. It was really quite a remarkable experience, and because I felt I was discovering the story as it went, and I didn't know how it was going to end until it ended, and it was the gift of a lifetime writing it. I mean, the pleasure of it, the excitement, and then after that, I mean, I've almost finished another novel, and it was nothing like that. It was horrible. It was, the usual. But this wasn't. This was just as though the story was being told me.
I was going to ask you, because it reminds me, you actually finishing a really fantastic first novel later in life reminds me of, like, Louis Buñuel, Picasso painting his paintings really later in life, or Louis Buñuel making his greatest films in his 70s. How many novels had you written before this, and did you need sort of like a lengthy sort of gestation period before you kind of hit upon the rat? Or?
No, I wrote a lot of poetry, which I was happily buried. And I published it. I published some for a while, and then did not get any satisfaction out of that. Seeing your poem in a little magazine, and you're in the woods somewhere. And anyway, I stopped publishing, and then I stopped writing it. And now I don't. I didn't want to look at it. Now and then I'd attempted a novel, but I didn't think I could write a novel. I didn't think I could. It was just not something I felt was in me. And I think. Even Furman, I'm not sure it's a novel in the sense in which most people think of it as a novel, because I think of it more as a poem in the sense that it's about states, it's about conditions, it's about solitude, it's about muteness. It's not about our social world. A novel so often have multiple plots, and we really, it's a social art form, while poetry is often a private art form. And so in many ways, Furman, although it has this prose form of a novel, it doesn't have many of the novelistic characteristics.
I would argue that Furman is largely very much about, consciousness.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering if you feel that consciousness isn't sufficiently explored in contemporary literature, and whether Furman is kind of an answer to that.
No, I think it's explored. I mean, I wouldn't want to name the books as explored, but I think it's explored. I don't think that, I don't want to say this is a better way of writing a novel.
Oh, sure, sure.
It's just the only way I knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's all I've got. And I suppose if I could, write a great social novel, if I could write like William Gaddis or Gilbert Sorrentino, then I would. I'd love to, but I can't. And I don't have that view of the social world and the political world and the world of conventions and pretensions, and that they would have, for example.
But, there's something also to be said for understatement. This book does tackle quite a lot. It talks, gentrification in Boston.
Yeah.
You have the writer, Jerry Magoon, who is this, whether he is a construct or not.
Right.
The point of this character is that there is this sort of, I guess, overall theme of decay throughout this book, that there's this kind of world or this consciousness that's sort of decaying. I mean, maybe, I don't know, can't quite remember what my question was here, but basically, maybe, there's more to be said by not saying much at all. Do you feel that way, or?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And the theme of decay and of the destruction of Scully Square, this was a perfect match for Furman's inner life. There was this reflection of the outer world, which was going the same way. There's a sense of doom which begins in the beginning, and by the very fact that he's a human rat, that he's that this can't turn out well, and so there is this mirroring, which interestingly came as a kind of gift as well. I mean, I didn't plan that, but I remembered Scully Square when I was late teenager in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. I used to go over there, and it was a place of Charlestown. Sailors from the Charlestown Naval Base would go over there on shore leave, and it had, strip clubs and pawn shops and passport photo shops and prostitutes, and it was just what they call blighted.
Yeah.
But it had used bookstores, oddly enough. And I would go over there, and I had that little piece of experience in my life, and when I began to write Furman, I put him in that bookstore, which I remember there was this big bookstore, and I put him in this bookstore, and of course it had gone, and there was the destruction right there. This was just, because I knew it had been destroyed. It was, again, one of these things that was just lying there, It's been lying there since I was 18 years old. Mm. And I hadn't even thought about it, and there it was.
It's in its own way, it's kind of, it reminded me very much of like how Times Square had been cleaned up, and how all of the, now it's pretty much a mini mall, you know, or a mega mall. I mean, was Times Square on your mind, or was it specifically this kind of memory?
Specifically that, and they didn't clean up Scully Square, they obliterated Scully Square. I don't know if you know Boston, but there's nothing there. There's nothing there but concrete and these enormous government buildings on this windswept strip of expanse of concrete. And now they're sorry, of course. Times have changed. Mm-hmm. And they're so sorry that they've actually taken paint and they painted in where the streets used to be. So you can walk over this expanse of concrete and you can say, oh, that was Hanover Street. That was Bridal Street. You know, because it's all gone. I mean, it was one of the oldest parts of Boston. All sorts of things were there. Mm-hmm. And had these little winding streets typical of Boston and so atypical of most American cities. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even gentrification. I mean, it was vandalism of the first order.
Sure.
And I mean, I suppose it was the last big project of that type that people carried out.
Sure. Sure. Now, was Coffee House the only publisher that you approached for this book?
No, I sent it to three or four, and Coffee House took it. And I'd worried about having it published because it was that my greatest qualms when I realized this was a rat was nobody's going to publish this book.
Yeah.
And they're going to think it's a children's book. They're going to, it's just going to be hard. And it wasn't hard. I mean, I would love to tell all these stories and say, oh, I've sent it to 100 publishers and they all rejected it. But that's not true. I sent it out and, you know, and 6 weeks later I had an invitation to submit the whole manuscript. And
oh, wow.
It was nothing.
Did you have any input on the illustrations that are in the book?
We did. We had the first suggestions were, and this has been a battle with Furman. I mean, with not a battle, but it's been a conflict of this. Some people who want to see this as a cute book.
Yeah.
And I was terrified of this, that he would be considered cute. And our first illustrations were cute. It was a cute rat. Yeah. And so I said, I want something like maybe German Expressionism. I don't want cute. And what we got is not cute. And so Michael Michalowski did these, did these illustrations, which are anything but cute. And now, so I was very happy with them because I felt that those illustrations push it the way I wanted it to go. You know, this is not Wind in the Willows, and this is not a story of a cute little furry. Yeah. And this is the problem in the beginning. When I thought it wouldn't be published, was that I thought people would say, oh, this is an animal story.
It reminded me to some degree of like Ralph Steadman's illustrations for Hunter S. Thompson's work, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, to some degree, but a little bit more like as if like Ralph Steadman had kind of laid back a little bit, but showed the sort of dirt, the grime, and the authenticity.
Yeah, they're very witty. They're very witty, the illustrations. If you look at them carefully, that little details, nice little touches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many drafts did Furman go through? I mean, were there sort of, you know, threads about Furman that didn't make it into the book, or, you know, you described earlier kind of sort of struggling with this a bit.
No, Furman went through, I mean, of course it went through many drafts, if you call drafts polishing steps. Otherwise, it went through one draft. That is, I did not move on to the next paragraph until I'd rewritten the paragraph I was working on four, five, six times. Mm-hmm. And then I go to the next, and I go to the next. And it was a strange way to write, but that was the way this was written. And so by the time I got to the end and knew how it was going to end, I had rewritten the first part many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, it went through many drafts, but another, only one. You know, after that, I didn't change anything.
I wanted to follow up on the point you had made in the previous question about, like, you know, your concern that people would think that this was cute or that they wouldn't take the sort of really deep themes in this seriously. Mm-hmm. Was this kind of ever an issue during the actual writing of this? Because, I mean, there is a lot of wit in this book. There is a lot of, you know, really sort of, you know, very pointed kind of observations about things. And they also exist with this, you know, really kind of moving story. Mm-hmm. What did you do as a writer to kind of sort of control or corral all these elements so that everything kind of flowed in a natural thing where one particular thing was not particularly prominent over another?
Well, that I had the problem, this is a first person narration, and my narrator is a sentimentalist. Mm-hmm. He's sentimental. He's maudlin. And so I had the problem of having a first-person narrator telling a sentimentalist telling a story which I did not want to be a sentimental story. And so I had to back off with a kind of bitter irony at certain moments in order to break that. Because Furman is really, I mean, he doesn't have very good taste sometimes. He's full of self-pity. He's full of self-loathing. And self-dramatization. And I didn't want that to be me, you know. So that was a little bit of a problem. But I think the fact he was a rat, you know, with this metaphor, with this image, what you've got is a kind of irony machine. That is, anything Furman says comes out differently. When Furman says, I'm in love with the women at the Rialto Theater, yeah, you think, well, that's a nice, warm, sentimental statement, but it's made by a rat.
Yeah.
You see, and so it immediately gets obliterated as such a statement and flipped over, and it becomes a kind of parody of the statement.
Yeah.
And so this kept it, I think, from falling into sentimentality, because every statement he makes, because he's a rat, becomes ludicrous. You know, and the problem, I mean, not the problem, but an aspect of it is that Furman knows that this is ludicrous.
Yeah.
That is, so he's on the one hand, he's making these dramatic or sentimental statements. They're ludicrous because he's a rat. He knows they're ludicrous because he's a rat. And that, again, feeds the self-pity, the drama, but now on another level of irony and of sentimentality.
Yeah.
And so this they played against each other almost automatically. That was just given again, that controlling image of the human rat.
I think points to a device you use to actually go ahead and sustain that irony. For example, like the women at the Rialto Theater are referred to as the lovelies.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of signs as represented in this text, like, for example, the painless dentist. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering. Yes, this is a sort of, you know, this is as much a chronicle of books as it is about this particular sort of human rat perspective.
Right.
And I'm wondering, what steps did you take to sort of tie these two threads together? Because, I mean, they really are sort of seamless the way, and particularly when did you decide the moment, like a particular narrative moment was right to kind of announce that, oh, you know, there's this painless dentist sign, or there are these signs over these particular shelves reading, you know, restroom and fiction and the like. I mean, because place is very much defined by the words and the signs. And I found that to be a very interesting environmental detail of yours.
Yes, he does the word, because words are always Furman, since he doesn't have language.
Yeah.
That is, language is the language is ultimately the longed for object, even more than the lovelies would be. Words and languages, these words appear as objects, as things in themselves, fiction, restroom. He sees these and they stand out because this is language.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he doesn't have. And he also sees himself, he not only sees signs, but he gives titles to his actions. You know, he'll put in these phrases, which are in fact titles of books he's thinking, in which he is the character. So he always sees himself as being a protagonist of some story.
Yeah.
Because what Furman wants most of all is to be in a story.
Sure.
And of course, I gave him that in the end, but he didn't know that. But
yeah,
he would like to be a character in a story because he will have meaning, as we all have meaning when we can make ourselves part of a story. And the senselessness of Furman's life, which it really is, I think, a senseless life from his perspective, is that he doesn't get to be in a story. He's not part of any narrative, because he's outside of the spoken world in which we all live, in which all of our narratives intersect, you know, our family narratives, our national narratives, our religious narratives, our personal narratives. He doesn't have any of those, because he only has the stories he can tell himself in his head. But a story you tell yourself in your head is no different than a dream. So at the end, if you recall, Furman doesn't know whether he's told a true story.
Yeah.
He doesn't know the name of his mother anymore.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, because this language is a private language, he has no way of knowing whether any of the things he's saying is no verification, no amplification, that his language, which he longs for so much, all he has is a mental reflection of it. And because it's private, it has no grounding. It's no different from a dream.
And there is one thing, actually, and it's thinking about how he is the sort of protagonist of his own story. There are certain threads in this book that are not necessarily followed up, and I was wondering if this was deliberate. The one sort of thing that comes to mind is when Furman is lusting after his sister, mm-hmm. and he says, "This is the last normal sexual desire right. I will ever experience," but he doesn't actually say what his abnormal sexual desire is, unless, of course, we're talking about the Lovelies.
Well, that's what I would be thinking. Yeah, yeah. It would be the Lovelies.
But it leaves a note of ambiguity that sort of suggests mm-hmm. that maybe this isn't entirely fully explained. Or this is, you know, I was wondering if this was kind of an intention of yours to leave some, you know, to leave it kind of ambiguous enough so that it doesn't, it's possibly a sort of an abnormal sexual desire that is not just the Lovelies, but perhaps something that extends beyond this. I mean, because you're also dealing with notions of incest as well with the initial sexual desire. So, you know,
I don't think that aspect entered my head. I don't think that was something that I reflected on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there are lots of things in that I didn't know about.
Yeah.
But that was not something that I consciously was exploring at that point.
Sure.
That is, this remark about the last, this was another one of Furman's ironic reversals, which he does often of our conventional assumptions, and that, again, to keep it, as I say, they would flip it out of that animal story.
Yeah.
And, oh yes, now we are in love with this other rat, but we don't, it's his sister, and we have the ironic statement, this is my last normal.
Yeah.
And from now on, I'm a freak.
Yeah.
Because he's a freak from the beginning, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And now he's supposed to be a freak because what he loves is what most normal, quote-unquote, America males are supposed to lust after, namely the women at the Rialto, right? And a normal sexual desire is lusting after a female rat.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's all this play on what's normal and what's abnormal. And everything in Furman in the end becomes abnormal because there's no, just as he has no public language, he has no public measure. He only has what he can find in books as being standards, but these standards are actually dreamlike. He can't, you know.
It's also about this. I think I agree with you that it's also about this reference point, particularly the whole phrenological sort of model
right.
with like the bookseller clerk, mm-hmm. Which he uses to sort of try to kind of determine a meaning out of. So it's, you almost comment as well on the sort of the dangers of actually dwelling entirely on books. You know, I mean, Furman is in many ways kind of like, I mean, it's sort of like, yes, it presents a character who has completely submerged himself in books, but for good or for bad. And I'm wondering if at any point during the writing of this, whether sort of, you know, the conscious experience of like, you know, getting a, for example, taking a break by like, you know, wandering around and exploring like the, what's in all the elaborate systems inside the ceilings
mm-hmm.
and the like that, you know, how did you balance sort of like the sort, you know, reading versus actual sort of human/rat kind of like experience?
Well, the reading experience is, of course, in one sense, the reading experience we all have.
Yeah.
That is, it's that we open a book and we vanish from the world and we enter that other world. And he compares that world for him with the tunnels, and he says, well, this is like reading a book, right? Wandering these tunnels is like reading a book. Because again, we have the question of the reality and the unreality, and what's supposed to be real are those tunnels in the bookstore. And those are real, and Dostoevsky's not real. And wandering in Dostoevsky's tunnels are somehow not real. But for Furman, they're just as real as I think they are for any reader. And when we, especially young readers, if we all remember when we would open the book and vanish,
mm-hmm.
right, and we'd enter those tunnels, and so there's a question of, you know, of why do we want to accord this reality to so-called reality, and denying it to so-called imagination, because imagination is just as real. It's merely another kind of reality, but it's not less real than that garage out there. It's only another kind of reality in Furman. So we have these two things in Furman parallel. And sometimes he might go walk through the tunnels of his bookstore or wander the shelves, but other times he might walk through the tunnels of Huckleberry Finn. And these are really, in terms of being valid worlds, these are equivalent. Not ontologically, but in terms of their value, they're equivalent. One's as real as the other. The imagination is as real as the physical world. You know, it's not less real. It's just different.
Okay. I wanted to comment also about, again, the Boston gentrification. I mean, was this always sort of at the back of your mind? Did you always intend to set this, you know, around that time, around 1960? Or was this something that kind of came as you were sort of writing and discovering the book?
And that was there from the beginning. Uh-huh. You know, that I knew, as soon as I knew this was a rat, I very quickly knew where he was and I knew when he was. And, you know, I was 20 years old at the epoch at which I played Furman. And I've thought about Furman, and then I realized that, you know, Furman never grows up. In a certain sense, he remains that. Furman's mind is very much the mind of an adolescent. And I thought, why didn't Furman grow up? And again, he didn't grow up because he didn't have any companions. Yeah. And what does it mean to grow up? It means to leave that solipsism, right? That we remember when we were 16 and 17, this self-absorption.
Yeah.
Furman never gets out of that.
Sure.
And I thought, why didn't he get out of it? Well, he couldn't get out. And this was only afterward, after I finished publishing the book, that I thought I had this reflection. I thought, well, he never got out of it because he couldn't. Because that was another aspect of not really having any others. And so there was no way in which Furman could grow. He stunted, and he stunted again because the public language is missing. He only has his daydreams. And we can't mature on daydreams. We can only, there's no reality to run up against in that sense, you know, and there's no, they just, so Furman in the end remains, you know, remains an adolescent in his sentiments and in his, you know, what does Furman think of love? He thinks of love as just lust of girls with you know, with big tits.
Yeah.
He has no idea what it would be like to live with a woman, and this is beyond him because he can't encounter, because he's missing the tools which that encounter could happen.
This also kind of ties into another, you know, question. I mean, you have a background, of course, in philosophy, a considerable background.
Alas.
You know, yeah. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, given that we're talking about things that aren't normally in contemporary literature, that, in fact, you know, people like James Wood and Sven Burkitt sometimes often declares war on, like, you know, sentimentality or sincerity along these lines. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you how much of Furman is intended as a sort of philosophical parable, whether you, and if so, or if not, whether sort of, you know, this kind of sentimentality, this potential sort of didacticism was a concern for you when you were kind of, obviously the notion that it would be misconstrued as cute was a concern for you, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering if this notion of didacticism or sentimental, or wearing emotions on your sleeve like this, I just threw a whole bunch of questions at you at the same time, but hopefully we can jump from there.
Was sentimentality a word? I'm not quite sure. Could you go back over?
Yeah, okay. So anyway, you have a background in philosophy.
Right.
As a result, was any of Furman intended as a sort of philosophical or parable?
Right, okay, I'll answer that.
Simultaneously, you know, because cute was a sort of concern of yours, was didacticism or the sentimentality in this novel also a concern, or also sort of something that you had to really kind of hone down?
Okay, the first part about philosophy, it was not conscious. If it's there, it was only because it was as part and parcel of writing the story. This is not, you know, a Roman Clay or anything like that. It's not a philosophic novel. I didn't set out to explore, you know, reality and dream, any of those things. You know, I set out with a character, and the character and the situation, and that's what determined it. That's what drove it. And so ideas in the more abstract sense played no role in the actual driving of the novel, I don't think. This is not a philosophic novel in that sense. And I probably, because as you say, I spent many, many years reading nothing but philosophy. I'm woefully ignorant in literature because I spent so many years reading nothing but philosophy, and I suppose it has to have left a mark, although I never read it anymore. And I haven't for 20, 25 years, but it must have left a mark. But it was not a so it was not a this is not a philosophical novel in any conscious way. And if, and the other question about the sentimentality, again, this is, you know, just to speak personally, I grew up in a I suppose in a family and in an environment in the late 1950s in which I couldn't distinguish genuine emotion from sentimentality. I could not tell, you know, genuine feeling from what than the feeling I got out of pop music. And so it took me a long time personally, many years before I was able to get over notions that were handed us, which are basically sentimental notions, which are just slack. And, you know, notions of love and of devotion and of patriotism and of all of these things, which were basically, you know, they're basically sentimental. They're just a, an enjoyment of a certain type of feeling. And but the feeling itself is the object. What you really want to do is to experience some kind of throe. I'm in the throes of love and the throes of that. And and I knew other people of my own age who didn't suffer from this debility, but I did. And so I suppose I know it's left huge marks on me, and the struggle against a tendency to a kind of sentimentalism is constant. It's constant. And so I imagine it would appear in Vermin, because it appears in my life that you're always, I always want to go back to the slack. Yeah. I would really be much happier there. I think, you know, so I think that's just a personal confession, and I'm sure it must appear in the book in that conflict, because for many years that was, you know, I admired the worst poetry you can imagine. I mean, good poets, you know, yeah. Byron or Shelley, but they're worse stuff, right? It's just horrible. And it took me years of John Donne and such things as this to try to purify my mind of this kind of formless, what is sentimentality? It's like emotion without form. It's emotion for its own sake, you know, where you just, instead of looking at, you know, you don't look at the loved one, you look at your own self loving, you know, and it has no form. It's this wave in which you can then bathe in it, but you can't do anything with it, and it doesn't accomplish anything in your life and doesn't help anyone. In fact, and so it's there. This is all through it.
You know? But, you know, this actually raises a very interesting question, a question that I think is sort of left open and sometimes answered in Vermin, and that is the sort of, you know, the omnipresent forces of culture in many forms, mm-hmm. not just in terms of objects, in terms of books. I mean, the way that the books transform the bookseller into this sort of, like, cold, scrupulous sort of mm-hmm. guy who's really assessing the goods, mm-hmm. which is sort of a remarkable emotional twist right. from, like, you know, someone who genuinely loves books right. to someone who is looking at these as just, like, from a shrewd right. capitalistic standpoint. Mm-hmm. What I'm sort of getting from Vermin, and what I'm sort of inferring from your answer for the previous question, is that I guess Vermin might have been a way for you to kind of show how cultural forces and how, you know, social forces or the things that we have to do in life completely sort of, like, you know, create this emotional dichotomy that, you know, that some of us may have trouble distinguishing, or that the misfit, you know, who's trying to kind of, you know, get by on his own terms can't because he doesn't have the manual for how to live or right. whatnot. Was this, maybe you could sort of elaborate on this. I mean, like, for example, like the bookseller who switches from, you know, from seeming sort of, like, you know, passionate about books to capitalistic cutthroat the next.
Well, yeah, we have that. We have the discussion of when the books are brought in and yeah. the station wagon, and then Vermin laments the books have the dedications.
Sure.
So the in them of the people who previously owned them. And so he remembers when these books were objects of human intercourse, were elements in a relation of people to other people, mm-hmm. and to the which was not a commercial relation. That, you know, the books are dedicated to friends or to loved ones, and then they're taken in the and the price is penciled in. They become marketable. commodities.
Yeah.
And I suppose it, you know, I suppose that what we're talking about is sentimentality, is this formless sort of emotion. I think that is very much a marketable commodity. Mm-hmm. I think this is what sells. This is what sells in books, right? You pick up books all the time. I see great reviews of books, and I happens all the time, and I open them and I can't finish them.
Yeah.
You know, and I read the review, and they'll say, you know, and there'll be these words about this. You know, this dramatic or tragic account of a person and his encounter with the loss of his wife, and I think, oh, this might be interesting. And I don't really think that anymore. But once I thought that, and sometimes it has been and could be, but it almost never is. Mm-hmm. It's almost always just that stuff, right? Just that stuff. Oh, here's how we feel when our wife dies, and the terrible thing is that's how we do feel when our wife dies.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess it's always been that way. I don't know, but I think it has. I think it has something to do with. I don't know. It has something to do with. I don't know what it has. It has to do with form in some way, and not being able, not having the forms in which we can say these things. You know, we don't. You know, we can't. We've so gone so far into the idea of spontaneous expression that we've almost become inarticulate. We can't say anything anymore.
Well, it's also may have something to do with like the co-opting of language. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, this is why I'm pissed off at Hallmark. They've taken all of these sort of right. you know phrases that we have said over
That's
the
right.
years, and now
taking our Shakespeare.
Yeah, yeah, they've taken our basically our little quotidian sort of nice statements that we say to each other. And we can't say them
That's
because
right.
they've taken it
That's right.
and they've made it a sort of corporate
and,
tool.
And they own them. They own yeah. them now. You see, you don't.
They trademark these phrases too.
They trademark them. They yeah. sell them. Buy and sell them. And ownership is everything. And they own them.
Yeah.
And we don't accept in you know in the privacy of our minds, but publicly, the public ownership is now slipped from us, and that's
yeah.
that's terrible. Not, you know, it's not. I'm not the person to do anything to correct that.
Yeah.
Well, I think some people are. I mean, I think there are novels. I think again, I just mentioned those two. I mentioned in the beginning, you know, William Geddes and Gilbert Sorrentino.
Yeah.
I think they were waging a tremendous battle against that. Each and you know, but that's not where I am.
Yeah,
I don't have that. Public grasp, that grasp of the social world, you know, and it's back where I am is back somewhere back inside that my mind.
But
kind of mind.
You do have, like, if we follow the trajectory of the bookseller, mm-hmm. what does he do at the end? He's giving, well, he does something that's completely counter to his ideology, to this shifting thing, and it becomes, and again, you know. Demonstrating that I think what you have demonstrated with a bookseller, at least, you know, maybe you can sort of talk about this, is that, you know, not everyone is so dedicated to a particular sort of set ideology or a set irony, particularly as the world constantly sort of changes, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's exactly what happens. It's the world's very sort of changing that causes him
right.
to do something completely drastic, to mm-hmm. totally, momentarily upset this inevitable obliteration, but then
right.
at the same
exactly.
time, then we're talking about something that's maybe, you know, if we look at it representatively, it's almost like pessimistic, because it's like, okay, so the guy's able to like put a, you know, throw a wrench into the wheel and stop it for about 5 minutes, but then boom, it all comes crumbling
well,
down.
Yes, he does. He's selling these books, and then he gives away the books, right? In this moment of despair and or triumph, however you want to look at it. And of course, Jerry Magoon, the person who befriends Furman, represents also a struggle against this. That is,
yeah.
you know, and this is 1960, and Jerry wants to go to San Francisco, you know, and things are happening out there, and so this is a little allusion to things that were happening out there, mm-hmm. you know, but right up here on my refrigerator, I have a picture of from Virginia Military Institute of all the cadets reading Howl.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You notice that? Okay. Well, that's.
I'm in San Francisco. I've seen that's everywhere.
Okay. So that's
yeah.
that. There you go.
Yeah.
That's what happened, right?
Yeah.
That's how that would. It was. It was perhaps more long lasting than the bookseller's revolt in which he gave away his books.
Yeah.
But in the end, it did not endure because they own it and they you know they'll take it and they have it, you know, and you cannot, you know, nobody 25 years old can read Allen Ginsberg the way we read Allen Ginsberg.
Yes.
You know, it's been taken. It's been taken, and yesterday they took a Shakespeare. They've taken that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't get that back. And so, that you know, there, but there are other things, and there will be other things. you know, but it's a constant struggle in which our culture just swallows, right?
Yeah.
Swallows, and then you have to invent something new.
There's one other, you know, repetitive kind of, repetitive implies that you're doing it tediously, but I think it actually was done with some purpose, and that is we constantly see people's living places and people's apartments and the bookstore, you know, men coming in and taking every known possession so that there's nothing but sort of barren space. This in itself, you know, this kind of representative of entropy to some degree, you know, it seemed very, very much philosophical to me. I was wondering...
You're talking about the final destruction when the buildings are exposed?
Just before the final destruction, there's like, you know, like after Magoon, you know... After Magoon's fate, I don't want to give too much away because we want people to read your book. But after Magoon's fate, like, you know, there, what happens to his, you know, place of living, where everything starts to kind of, you know, disappear, just as what happens to the bookstore before any of the sort of, you know, I guess, well, we already said an apocalypse, I'll bleep it out or something. You know, I'm wondering, you know, if this kind of like, you know, this seemed very, very specific to me, this whole notion of like, before you could have complete, you know, annihilation, everything must be reduced down to absolutely nothing. And I'm wondering if how, maybe, what were your intentions in terms of like, this specific sort of a notion of I guess, material attrition is what I'd like, I think that is a good term for it.
What were my notions of the role it would play in...
I see what you're saying in terms of how culture is kind of like, you know, co-opting our playfulness, our inventiveness, our sincerity, in terms of like, you know, evil forces, like, you know, like capitalism, like people who, you know, declare war on the misfits. I totally get that. What I don't get, and what I find interesting, is the way that you have... this kind of, okay, well, we've got to go ahead and take the actual place where this happens and whittle it away down to nothing.
Right.
You
the,
know?
The destruction of this, destruction basically of Furman's world.
Yeah.
And the world of those who live in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what to say to that. I mean, are you asking me whether I think our world is on the verge of apocalypse?
No. I'm not getting the question. Okay. Let me try to phrase this. Okay. Whereas another author could have just completely, like, you know, obliterated the world.
Right.
Before you even obliterated the world, you actually had, like, people come in and collect possessions and reduce the material basis of that world down to nothing.
Right.
Which is a very interesting distinction. So I wanted to ask... why this additional step before complete obliteration? You know what I mean?
I, this is not something that I consciously thought, well, I could do it this way or I could do it that way. But there was a time in which I suppose I thought that what was coming was obliteration. I mean, I grew up in the atomic age.
Yeah.
I think that again, the things are being taken away one at a time. I think there is a kind of slow motion, theft in which things are being, you know, more and more is being swallowed and we're left with less and less. And so in that sense, yeah, I think there's this piecemeal that we're not, I mean, of course we have to worry about total destruction, but what we really have to worry about is, you know, is attrition, is you know, the grinding away of the things that matter, the taking away bit by bit. I think that's just the way I see it is going, and maybe that's just because I've now lived a human span, what you know, as long as most people think people have a right to live, really, and. And that's what happens, you know. I wasn't shot and I wasn't hit by a car when I was 30, but one does. Things go bit by bit, and this is the way it ends. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't Not with a bang. and not even with a whimper, but, you know, one loses things, you know, along the way. And that's a purifying element. That is, one becomes cleaner and leaner. Yeah. If one realizes it didn't really matter, you know, if you're on life's journey and you do get things, you know, you let go of a lot of stuff and you become lighter and you're left with less. But what that less is clearer and cleaner, and you know more what you think and what you want. Of course, you regret you didn't know that earlier and couldn't have thrown it overboard when you were 25. But
this is an interesting sort of thing. Maybe this is why this, you know, attrition needs to happen. Because even like a guy like Jerry Magoon clings to certain things. I mean, even like that piano that, you know, Furman plays. These are all sorts of like, you know, even clinging to a material object, even, you know, to become a misfit or to become, you know, to live a independent existence outside of this kind of culture is, in a sense, kind of perhaps supporting it, you know. Again,
Jerry supports it as little as possible. Jerry's activity when he's not writing stories of the end of the world, his stories end in apocalypse, is trying to repair the world. He repairs objects, toasters. And this is so. This is what he's trying to do in his life. That is, this is what people like Jerry at that moment in 1960 or 61. That is, people of his subculture. Mm-hmm. We're trying to repair the world. You know, as I think all writers, in a sense, are trying to repair the world, recover the word, repair the word, and Jerry is, you know, he's constantly finding these objects which the mass culture is thrown out, right, broken toasters, and he's trying to fix them, right, because this is attrition. The toaster broke, the radio broke, this, that broke, and it's always grinding down, and he's trying in his way to sort of put a finger in.
Well, it's interesting that because he comes smack dab in the middle of, like, you know, World War II, where a lot of people actually had to, you know, save things for, you know, save scrap mm-hmm. material and actually, like, you know, mm-hmm. You know, go ahead and fashion things along those lines, versus, you know, what happened in the late 60s in terms of wanting to change the world.
Right.
So he actually falls smack dab within that center, and it's almost as if you are portraying this kind of interesting sort of historical shift in terms of what motivates,
yeah, that's right,
what motivates, I guess, basic operations, or, you know,
mm-hmm. yes, and Jerry is actually, he's a veteran, although he apparently did not see combat, but he also is a farmer.
Yes,
if he came from rural North Carolina, so there's a conserving, you know, his background is background is not Boston, it's not the city. It's in a sense that something more in touch with growth than say the world in which he's now found himself.
Well, and he's also stoic because he doesn't get upset when people basically belittle him.
Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah, no. Yeah. He's quite. You know, there was a man named Al Magoon who used to pull a wagon around Boston. I never knew him, but my sister, my oldest sister, who lived in Cambridge in the mid-50s, and my whole family for some reason would migrate out of South Carolina to Cambridge, and we'd all reach the age of revolt, and we'd all go to Boston. Anyway, she'd been there first, and she told me about this man, I guess was gone when I got there, Al Magoon, and she told me, she said, he was the smartest man in the world. You know, and it's funny how you find these things. It's like Scully Square. Mm-hmm. There was this little memory lying around since I was 12 or 13 years old. This was the smartest man in the world. And I thought, who, I don't know who he was, Al Magoon.
But, you know, who sets the standard of who, what's smart? I mean, you know, again, this goes back to, like, what is genius? Are they misunderstood? Or do you have to be crazy to be a genius? And, you know, I mean, and Furman thinks of, you know, Magoon as a genius too.
He thinks of himself as a genius.
And he thinks, yeah.
He thinks of himself as a great literary genius. Yeah. Who, unfortunately, we don't have the works.
Yeah.
Right. Although, we have to doubt that because we have examples at the beginning of his first lines.
Exactly.
So we wonder whether Furman is not really a hack in the end. And this was one of the first I had, you know, first I thought I had to make Furman write his mental novel badly. Mm-hmm. I didn't want Furman to really be a good writer. And he goes, he's writing in his head. But in the end, I said, well, no, this is what I'll just write, you know, as best I can. And we'll just say this is Furman, when he came to talk about himself, discovered gifts he didn't otherwise have, because his first sentences, they suggest that he, his ideal literary genius, he might not apply very high.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's all I have. But Sam, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chit-chatting with you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Great.